Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, February 26, 2025, we're delighted to host a program on the DOJ in transition. What may be coming next? My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts. On today's program, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, we will keep our introductions of our guest today brief, certainly more brief than their distinguished careers would deserve. So if you're interested, I highly recommend you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. I'll go ahead and introduce our moderator and leave it to him to introduce our guest for today. We have as our moderator, John Richter, who is a trial and investigations partner in the Special Matters and Investigations Practice Group at King & Spalding. He's also a department veteran, as he previously served as an acting assistant attorney general in charge of the criminal division at USDOJ and as U.S. attorney for the Western District of Oklahoma. Like I said, sure. A last note, and then I'll get off your screens. Throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Richter, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Kayla, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. I'm pleased to have a chance to speak here with Greg Sofer. Greg, most recently, was a partner at the Hush Blackwell law firm, and of course, prior to that, most recently served as the United States Attorney for the Western District of Texas, one of the largest U.S. Attorney's offices in the United States. He's a Texan. Prior to his time as U.S. Attorney, he served as counselor to the Attorney General of the United States. He served as 12 years as an assistant United States attorney, handling national security, violent crime, corruption cases. He served as the chief, the criminal chief in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Western District of Texas, and was responsible for supervising 120 assistants in that office. And prior to becoming an assistant United States attorney, he served as a trial attorney in the National Security Division at Maine Justice. Prior to his time as a federal prosecutor, he also served as a state prosecutor for about a decade. So Greg comes to us, obviously, as someone who knows the Department of Justice, has seen it at all different levels, from the line to the very, very top. In multiple administrations, and obviously also served as a state prosecutor. So I look forward to speaking to Greg. And of course, Greg brings some interesting perspective because he obviously served at the highest level during the first Trump term and had a role in helping the second term come on board in transition at the Department of Justice. Importantly, however, he is not going to be speaking about any of the information that he learned during that transition. And he's here in his private capacity and certainly not speaking for the administration, his former law firm, or any other entity. So with those lawyerly admonitions and statements, let me get started here, Greg. First of all, welcome to the webinar. I want to start with some topics that are super unremarkable. I don't think anybody's interested in them. No real controversy, and that is this notion of and this memo on weaponization. Seems like there's really nothing to talk about there, but some people seem to want to talk about it a lot, and seem to find some controversy in it. So I thought we'd start there and see what gets your sense of things. You know, when I think about this concept, I immediately come to the old Soviet Chief Beria, who was attributed to say, "Show me the man and I'll find the crime." Tell me, you know, from your perspective, Greg, your reaction, obviously, to the weaponization memo and your reaction to the debate that's ongoing about this concept that we're seeing and hearing so much about.
Well, thanks, John, for having me, and I appreciate you starting with the easy questions first. That's kind of you, so we can sort of slide into all of this. Look, none of this should be a sort of secret to anybody. The president, current administration, experienced something highly unusual in American political and DOJ history. And I think, obviously, the president and the people around him believe that he was targeted, as you describe, in a Stalinist regime. That was how it was done. I don't think anyone's quite gotten to that accusation, but pretty close. And I think, you know, it's hard to argue with it on some level based on the number and the quality and the nature of some of the prosecutions and even civil cases that have been brought. And so it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. The president ran on this, that he was going to want to look at this. And I think it's a real issue that needs to be explored. The Department of Justice, its reputation has changed. People's confidence in it has changed significantly over the last few years. And, you know, you and I both know this. It's a very, very, very small percentage of the cases that the Department of Justice and all its people handle have had this effect on the population and really been the focus of so much media attention. It's, you know, the day-to-day work of the department doesn't fall into any of these categories. But I think the president and the people around him and the attorney general has made this clear as well, are interested in trying to understand how this all happened. And I think for the department's sake, it's important to explore some of that. In order to try to restore some confidence in the organization. There are dangers, obviously, associated with doing this. You can get into this tit-for-tat concept where everyone's investigating the last administration and the last group of people. This has been, in my time in the Department of Justice, we've ratcheted this up over time. I remember when Bush was the president and we had a lot of controversy about how we were handling terrorism and Iraq. There were people inside of the department and inside the White House who people started saying these people should be prosecuted and investigated for some of the opinions that they had rendered about whether it was interrogation or other kinds of significantly controversial issues. And it slowly has gotten to this point where finally in the last administration, I think they really almost jumped a shark on it and went all the way. And for whatever reason, in previous administrations, in previous history, we haven't done that as a country. And this opens up this idea. And so here we are in a position where the Trump administration and the Trump DOJ is going to want to take a look at how this all happened and whether this was an appropriate use of the concept of targeting somebody or not. Look, we've been targeting people for some time. I mean, this happens in the national security realm. It happens in a lot of, in the drug realm as well. It happened to Al Capone. The concept being that somebody is bad, somebody is up to no good, someone is a danger to the country. You know, I was trained as a national security prosecutor. We were told, look everywhere, see if there's child pornography on the computer, see if they've got a tax violation, because what was our job? Our job was to disrupt the next potential terrorist attack. And so it's not wholly a new concept. It's a real question of whether or not it was done in an appropriate way. And again, I think there's a pretty good argument looking at the record that's something that should be looked into.
I think one of the big questions in this whole area, Greg, is you speak of tit for tat, is where does it end? Can it end? What the alternative seems to be, excuse me, you know, trying to return to normalcy and whatever that is. And the idea that we should just be moving on down the road, why do you think this administration has chosen to not do that, besides just the fact that obviously they want to understand what happened before?
Yeah, I mean, again, as a lawyer, I could make this argument either way. I think there's some big philosophical questions about this. You could turn the other cheek, right, and move on business as usual. I think the idea, and there's a good argument that that's the right thing to do for the department and the right thing to do for the government. Someone can make that argument for sure. I think the view of this administration, and again, it's something that resonates with me to some extent, is if you don't do anything, and we go back to quote normal is what resulted in the situation that put Donald Trump and a lot of people around him in harm's way. And I think the idea here is we shouldn't be going back to normal, that over the years, the institution itself has turned in a certain direction. There's very, very few people on the line and inhabit the Department of Justice and many other parts of the government that are true conservatives, for instance, or supporters of the president. I think the statistics are very clear about that. So going back to normality is not necessarily an option that the administration, I think, is interested in getting back to, because I think they think the normal state of affairs is broken. But again, to your point, I think that a tit for tat, we're going to go back and forth like this, that only ends when one side wins. And I don't know what wins means in this context. And I think it's a dangerous position to be in. But this is also the position the country, and this is reflective of the general political environment that we find ourselves in the country. It's true in Congress. It's true in a lot of different places. You've got a polarized electorate, polarized policy questions. And there is a lot of tit for tat out there, depending on who's in power and who's running the show. So I don't think it's unique to this particular situation. I don't think it's unique to DOJ. I don't think it's necessarily unique to the government's administration. I think this is something we're seeing throughout the country on a very broad level. But I often say this to my clients, I'm sure you do too. I wish I had a crystal ball to tell you how this will play itself out. If I knew that turning the other cheek and letting things go back to quote normal was going to save the country from eating itself alive, then of course you would take that view. But I think a lot of people view this as an existential problem, and now is time to fight. And you can see, the administration is moving very quickly to try to make some big changes in a way that I've never seen during my 30 years of being a state and federal prosecutor.
Let's in terms of this tit for tat, I guess the question is, when you say sort of disarming, it raises the question of if the administration is doing what it's doing here, what happens the next time that there's a Democratic administration?
Yeah, I mean, I think about this all the time, and I assume that the folks who are running the show at this point do the same thing. You watch what happens just with executive orders, for instance. The more we move towards more executive orders and more far-reaching executive orders, the easier it is for the next crew to come in on day one, cross all that out, and start signing as fast as you can all the new executive orders. And again, this kind of pace and the amplitude of that change has become greater and greater over time. And I would very much expect that the next administration comes in, if it's a Democrat administration, whether that's in 4, 8, 12, whatever many years, and they do exactly that kind of thing. And I think that, again, this causes serious problems for the country. But I think, as I said, I think the last administration, the Biden administration, really pushed this so far that this is a natural consequence of their actions. And you can't just look at Trump and the administration's actions in a vacuum. You have to look at what happened to them and how they perceive what happened to them as well.
Let's switch gears. We're hearing about a lot of personnel decisions being made. No controversy there. There's no media coverage. No concern about who's making the decisions. It's all very matter of fact. You and I have talked about this before. how do you see the approach on personnel unfolding here? What's their method? What are they trying to achieve?
So again, I think the president ran very clearly on a number of different policy issues. To some extent, they're a little contradictory, right? When you actually go to execute them, he wants to make big changes in our immigration enforcement operations, and that's going to take a lot of human beings and a lot of work. They want to get serious on violent crime, which also takes a lot of human beings and a lot of work. And yet he also was elected, I think, very clearly as a result of a policy to try to reduce the size and scope and reach of the federal government. Again, you can't take out of the picture the fact that he and those around him were victims to some extent, at least in their minds, of what that big federal government has done. You and I have been practicing in similar environments. We see this all the time for the private sector, too. The administrative states rise, and the farther and farther the government reaches into business activities and tries to micromanage all of that. I think a lot of people voted for Donald Trump to get that big government, the big wasteful government, off their back. So you got two factors there. The fact that he feels that he was targeted inappropriately, personally, and the people around him as well. And you just have the general massive uncontrolled growth of the federal government and its reach into various different aspects of our lives that I think a lot of people don't appreciate. And so to do these two things at the same time, to shrink the size of the federal government, but also go out and enforce the immigration laws in a way that they haven't been enforced for a very long time, they run contradictory to each other. And I think that's going to cause some issues and problems. But I also believe that anyone who has tried this in the past, on any level, you know this from being a U.S. attorney, so do I, from being in a U.S. attorney's office, but I saw this at big DOJ. You try to cut anything in the Department of Justice, it's almost impossible. All it does is grow. It grows in new initiatives and new offices and new I ran a number of offices in the Department of Justice. It's all about FTE. How fast can I get more FTEs? And if anyone who has tried to even suggest that we should shrink or combine or somehow control the growth has been absolutely completely and utterly unsuccessful. They failed. So I think the theory here is, and this theory goes beyond just this personnel issue, is do it fast, do it hard, and do it in a way that actually is going to accomplish change. Now, is this going to all work? You can already see that there's plenty of challenges in the courts, and I think they understand that over the next 2 to 4 years, they're going to be fighting all these battles in court, but at least they're trying, and at least they're doing it in a way that they believe is going to make it move. Again, it's not a scalpel and tweezers approach where you spend a lot of time looking to see what exactly is being done here and how exactly is it being done and where are all the stats and how might we do that. It's very much a hammer. I've described it as that big Gallagher hammer he smashes watermelons with. And so, you know, these two choices each come with benefits and costs. And I think the theory here is if we don't do this big and we don't do it right at the beginning, it's such a mammoth, colossal problem. We'll never make a difference. And it's going to take all at least 2, if not 4, maybe longer than that to actually cut any of this because of all of the infrastructure that's in place to protect the government from any kind of shrinkage.
Interpret this concern being expressed about civil servants, and obviously in one of the memos that Attorney General Bondi issued up front, this notion that you've got to, you know, you don't get a choice as to what you get to enforce or the positions that you get to take. You're either in, and you know, so long as it's lawful and ethical to do, the fact that you may disagree with it personally is not an excuse for not participating. How do we think about this civil servants, the civil servants in this context, and this notion of, I guess, that gets pejoratively labeled as loyalty or lack of loyalty?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on this, and there's a long history of the purpose for all the civil service laws. I don't think they were intended to land where they currently are. And I think, you know, the executive branch is run by a chief executive. Everybody works for that person. They don't work for some unelected, unclear blob of federal bureaucracy. That's not an accurate depiction of this. Stephen Miller gave this civics lesson recently at the podium at the White House. The people voted for a president. The president ran on certain policies. He made them very clear. His job is to now execute those policies pursuant to the votes that he got from the people. I don't think people who sit in various levels of the federal bureaucracy get a choice to say, I'm not going to do that, or I'm purposely going to try to flout it, or I'm going to leak to the press to undermine all this. If you don't agree with it, you should leave. So long as the orders are, as you say, lawful and appropriate, your moral and your personal beliefs, if you don't agree with it, you should leave. But very few people do leave. Now, I think maybe some of this is designed so that those people who disagree do actually leave. That's possible. I don't know that it's been thought that through that much. But the bottom line is, I don't know how we got to a place where, and I've seen this myself, and if you had told me that this existed before I went up to Washington the last time, I probably would have called you some crazy conspiracy theorist. But I actually watched this happen. People just disagreed with what they were being told to do, and they dug their heels in, they leaked to the press, they undermined, they outright refused orders to go forward with things. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with disagreeing with it. But I don't think the civil service laws were designed to make sure to somehow have an executive branch where 90% of it, if they disagree with the president, just dig their heels and refuse to do anything. You'll never achieve any change. And again, I think this part of this is what the president was elected for, was a challenge to this giant unelected federal bureaucracy, which again, it's not just the big high profile issues. It affects everything down to the way the Department of Commerce sticks monitors on fishing boats. It's the same kind of concept.
Let me play out a hypothetical here, Greg. Let's assume that most of the federal prosecutors and personnel in the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. Were Republicans, and not, as we statistically seems to be the case, vote primarily by large majorities as for Democrats. How would that, in that hypothetical alternative universe, what would that mean if, in fact, they're sort of free to not follow lawful and ethical directives being given by the president?
Yeah, I mean, you don't really see very many instances of that because of what you just described. The statistics don't cause that to happen. But I would take the same position. I think, you know, it's the same concept. If the whole department was manned and womaned by Republicans, and a Democrat president was lawfully elected by the American people, and those folks just absolutely refused to follow orders or broke DOJ policy by leaking things to the press and purposely trying to slow down the president's agenda, I don't think it makes them heroes to do that, so long as these orders are lawful, lawfully coming from the executive branch. If they're lawful orders and they're ethically appropriate, then you have to do your job. That's the job that you took. And now, you know, of course, people will say, I took an oath to defend the Constitution. Well, the Constitution is what set this all out. So unless you can come up with a constitutional reason for not doing it, I don't think it matters whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. If you don't like it, And these are lawful orders. I mean, the immigration situation is to me the best example of this. There's no question that it is a crime to enter the United States illegally. It's not a very serious crime, but it is a crime. It's on the books. Congress doesn't like it. People don't like it. There's a way of changing that. But I don't think it's illegal or unethical It may be immoral to a lot of people, but if you have a moral problem with your job, you should quit and go do something else.
Let's talk about, I mean, certainly when I was in the department as a political appointee, I recall, instead of calling us the deep state, the deep state, what they called us was the Christmas help, meaning that we were just there for a very short season, and they knew they'd be there, you know, long after we were. That dynamic, you know, seems to have now, I guess, been, and those were, you know, more gentle times. We got called the Christmas help. That's not the worst thing that someone gets called in Washington, D.C. these days.
Certainly not.
In terms of this immigration and focus, and obviously a focus on narcotics and guns, let's talk a little bit about this shift in focus. Obviously, Attorney General Bondi has issued this memo. I think the administration, president, as well as the leadership in the department have been very clear about the direction that they want to go. You've already spoken a little bit about some of the challenges from a personnel staffing standpoint to get that job done, and how that may be in tension with some of the other priorities in terms of cutting, you know, waste at least, and making the executive branch hopefully more efficient. But tell us about this prioritization and from your standpoint, and why this administration is choosing to go in this direction. Because, you know, big firm lawyers, a big law is looking at certain things like the memo on Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and some of the other things out there, and scratching their heads about why some of these longtime areas are seemingly being deprioritized, at least in these top level memoranda.
You know, I mean, I think it goes back to sort of some very simple concepts. And again, the president ran on a number of these and made it very clear that this is what he was going to do. What is it that your average American, what is the number one job of the Department of Justice? It's to keep the American citizens safe. That's why so much has been poured into the national security apparatus. When that was such a huge threat to the citizens of the United States. It's to keep people safe. And I think there's a feeling that the department's gotten away a little bit from that main mission, or at least it's trying to do too many things with all these initiatives and press releases about new shiny kind of things. People have forgotten about the fact that your average human being, when they walk out of their house, I mean, I don't have this problem in my neighborhood, but many, many, many Americans do. And the problem is people are scared for their safety. And you have some serious violent crime problems. You have people in the United States now that clearly we don't know who they are, where they came from, or what their background is. There are fundamental, simple dangers to the American people that have not been addressed properly. And I think the idea here is not so much that we hate FCPA enforcement or we don't want to continue with one or more of the initiatives that the department announced in the last administration. It's more that we need to focus on the critical, simple problems that affect most Americans. And in order to do that properly, particularly if there's going to be some dwindling resources here, you're going to have to refocus all of your resources. And I think that they're doing that the best that they can. They've announced that they're doing it. This will be a work in progress, obviously. And as I said, as more and more people leave or are forced to leave, there may be some serious resource challenges. And what I have heard from my own investigation and discussions with people about the state of the department is there's not enough people in many places to do the job that needed to be done. And it's going to be hard to do some of these things without supplementing the existing personnel, much less if there's fewer people doing the job.
when I look at the numbers of cases prosecuted per assistant United States attorney year over year in the prior administration, I see numbers that are below where they were when I left the department in 2009, when there were even fewer people. And so it raises questions to me about productivity. I know each of us have experienced the fact that as, you know, when we were U.S. attorney or when we were assistant U.S. attorneys, we knew that there were people in our office, some of whom were incredibly hardworking and productive for the same salary as some people, or sometimes less salary than some people who really weren't getting much done. And yet we had few tools to do something about that. As this change in direction goes, we're already seeing, I guess, about the announcement of about 1,000 agents being moved from FBI headquarters to the field. Do you think there's going to be a change in terms of focus of prosecutors and agents away from the national security front to some degree as part of this reorientation? And if so, you know, what do you think about that? What are the consequences of that?
Yeah, so the national security apparatus has just blossomed tremendously since I started back in 2003 at the department, when it really was a skeletal fragment of what it currently is. And yeah, I think you know, you can make a strong argument that border security, for instance, is national security. I don't necessarily think it has to be sliced all the way through. But the bottom line is, I do think they're going to have to move some resources from even the national security conglomeration, and it's enormous. I mean, it's really almost unfathomable how much that has grown. As you point out, you know, the government's radically inefficient. It doesn't have to perform the way that a company does or a law firm does. It allows for a lot of inefficiencies. I hope that there'll be a strong effort, and there certainly appears to be, on focusing on efficiency. I know AUSAs who got paid $50,000 a year per case. To me, that's, you know, pretty outrageous. When the case was a felon in possession, you know, if it was I took the La Cosa Nostra down, that would be a different story. But the bottom line is, in these efficiencies, I think if they can be properly addressed, and none of this is going to be perfect, but at least you can move towards doing the things you want without really damaging the country's ability to protect itself, for instance, on the national security front. It's an incredibly dangerous political move, though, to the extent that anyone's able to characterize it as such. If I can make an argument that you took 50 people off the wall on the terrorism front to put them on the wall on the southern border, and then a bomb goes off in some major U.S. city, this administration is going to have to own that. And it's a very dangerous thing to do, and they'll have to be very careful in the way that they do it. But I do think that they'll have to move some resources from every place. I mean, it can be equally problematic if it's child pornography that you're moving people away from. But remember, the last administration moved people from almost every part of the Department of Justice to go do the January 6th case, the largest prosecution in U.S. history. And so I think that'll be looked at also. What was ignored during that period of time? And this administration will have to suffer the same kind of potential scrutiny if it moves people from places where something bad happens. This is the danger of being, you know, this being the U.S. attorney. I know this from my jobs. I stayed up at night worrying that something bad would happen because we were not doing, you know, covering everything, particularly on the national security front. The FBI's had to do that. The president is briefed every morning about this. It's a very, very scary concept. And to take the guard down in any way or not continue to build it is a dangerous concept politically, more than anything else, I think, at this juncture.
When you talk about the national security conglomerate and its growth, tell me about your impressions of it in terms of what it means in terms of actually fighting terrorism, for example.
Well, look, I mean, we obviously, as a country, were in a poor position on 9/11 and had not really staffed and thought about the implications of the way we had structured counterterrorism infrastructure in law enforcement and intelligence. Massive changes were made to that. A massive bureaucracy has grown. For those of us who prosecuted terrorism cases, for instance, that bureaucracy was sometimes incredibly helpful and often incredibly frustrating. There's 37 people had to sign off on everything you did. A lot of people never wanted to be AUSAs in the national security space because they couldn't take having 73 cooks on every case. And, you know, I think there were major inefficiencies there. And if anything, that's grown over time. They've built giant complexes outside of Washington, D.C. to handle all this. And I think as the threat has diminished, there are places for some of those people to go, which where their time and energy and the resource would be better spent. But this problem has not gone away. We still face a significant terrorism threat. And as I said, moving any of these resources around in any way, including, you know, some of the lawyers who check the boxes on some of the things that you asked for, has the danger of someone turning around and saying, see, the reason that a bomb went off in this mall is because we didn't have enough people to deal with it. I think this can be done. I think it should be done. I think this can be streamlined and made more efficient. But as I said, I think politically it's a very dangerous thing to do. And I don't know, you'll hear a lot about moving resources from the national security front to these other kinds of policy initiatives because I think it's so dangerous to do it.
We talked a little bit about violent crime for a second. One of the big initiatives that I think you and I probably lived with through most of our tenure in the Department of Justice was what was called Project Safe Neighborhoods. They named that in the George W. Bush administration. It had previously been called under Janet Reno and Clinton, called the Gun Violence Reduction Initiative. Obviously, the Bush administration were better marketers, better brand. Came up with a better brand name since it's kind of carried through as Project Safe Neighborhoods. How do you see, we've heard the announcement that the new FBI director is also been sworn in as the ATF director. And obviously there's been a lot of criticism in conservative circles on the right about firearms enforcement and Second Amendment rights. How do you see do you see Project Safe Neighborhoods carrying forward in some fashion? How do you see prosecutions using obviously what is effectively the statutes under the Gun Control Act of 1968?
Yeah. So again, I think there's a trend here, right? You have complex initiatives that touch on controversial issues, and then you have basic general law enforcement that actually makes a difference in people's lives. And I may be wrong about this. I'm a proud gun owner and a supporter of the Second Amendment, but I'm certainly not got my finger on the pulse of all of those issues. But I don't think it's that controversial that every single person in the United States who is possessing a gun and has a criminal felony conviction, for instance, for a violent crime, should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. I think at least on the right of American politics, I don't see that as a particularly controversial concept. And there's enough work there in many cities and many places to do that with all day, every day, hundreds, thousands of cases to take these guys off the street. I watched this happen in New York City. The more guns that came off the street this way, the more people who were felons and gangbangers and violent folks who we could put in a prison cell for a period of time, instead of them being roaming the streets of New York with an illegal weapon, the safer things got. And I just don't think it's that controversial. It shouldn't be very controversial, particularly on the right. Now, you know, all the issues with firearms tend to be controversial. I think where the last administration moved in place, you know, it did a lot of things that took, for instance, a legal weapon that someone has in their house, and suddenly somebody snapped their fingers and says that's a felony to be possessing that. And they really, a lot of the things they did, I think, were much more problematic, obviously, as far as firearms enforcement is concerned. But I will hope and I would guess that this administration will focus on the simple part, which is bad guy caught with gun. It's not that long of a case, not that complicated of a case. He's got 3 convictions for armed robbery. Why is that guy roaming the streets at this point? Again, I just don't see it as being particularly controversial. You're going after the person, not the gun at that point anyway. And it makes a lot of sense to me to do that kind of enforcement. I would expect the administration will focus on that. And I would be surprised if there's not some focus on that kind of case.
In observing over the years that the Department of Justice, and obviously most recently during the Biden administration, we've seen year over year, particularly in the last few years, a lot of memoranda and guidance memos on about whistleblowers and how they can report, and about compliance programs and how companies should cooperate with the government. Where do you think the department's going to go with a lot of that guidance? I mean, cynically, there were times where I felt there was more guidance, frankly, than there were actual investigations and prosecutions. But I mean, where do they go with these whistleblower and compliance guidance memos and concepts?
Yeah, well, so I mean, probably like you, I've been sitting in private practice waiting for the major spike in white collar prosecutions based on all of these initiatives, all this guidance, and it never happens. And you and I know why that is on some level, which is it takes forever to make many of these cases. Even if you announce a policy in 2 years ago, it takes 2 years sometimes to build those cases. And I know from having traveled the country, there's hardly anyone doing it. So it's a nice press conference. It looks good on paper that we're going to do this, we're going to do that. They never really put the resources into it. What they have done, though, is I think sort of switched the burden of who's responsible for doing DOJ's job. And they've tried to push as much of that burden into companies, for instance, with all of this guidance. And you're going to have a compliance program and it's going to look this way. And, you look at the Department of Justice's compliance program guidance. It's I forgot what the number is, but literally hundreds of questions that very much micromanage exactly how you're going to run your company. And again, I think this goes back to a simple concept, and one that the president ran on, and that I think people voted for him as a result of, was the government intruding too far, particularly the regulatory state, but it applies to the Department of Justice as well, into everyday life, whether that's corporate life or some other part of life, in a way that is inappropriate. And again, I think it makes sense. I could make a pretty good argument for why you want an army of compliance folks and whistleblowers, and you want everyone to follow what you're telling them how to do everything, because that means you don't have to do as much yourself. And it's not a question of whether people are breaking the law. It's just I've got the cops are now living inside the company. And it doesn't cause as much. It doesn't. There's an argument that will cause compliance and more law breaking. Except you and I both know it doesn't matter what kind of compliance program you have on paper. It matters how it's actually implemented. And again, I think it's a question of intruding deeply and in very specific ways into life that is being rejected And I think as part of that big philosophy, some of these white collar programs and the whistleblower stuff, I think, become potential targets of the new administration getting rid of them. I don't know what they'll do. Again, it's hard to, every one of these comes with a potential political price, right? You roll back some of these initiatives, you refocus them, something happens, there's a market crashing, market integrity, white collar case, you're going to own that and they're going to shove it in your ear. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, you can't do everything, and it really wasn't working. I mean, again, the truth on the ground is it really wasn't working. It did not produce a lot of cases, and maybe it produced so much compliance and so much lawful activity. There wasn't any a reason to have increased fraud cases. I don't buy it. My view is I saw the lack of resources being put into this in most communities, in most cities, most districts, that I think it was a lot of show and not a lot of, as you say, action.
We've got a series of some questions that have been posed by members of our fine audience here. We've got more than 100 participants here, which very grateful for. The first question I'll pose, I think, is going back to this weaponization, so-called weaponization working group. And the question posed is, if there is a thorough investigation, would we expect, even if there is no prosecution, for the facts to be made public? And if so, should they be made public?
I would expect the facts to be made public, and I think there's a strong argument for the facts that they should be made public. Whether there should be a prosecution gets back into this tit for tat concept, which we've already discussed. But another thing I think you can see over the whole government at this point is a push for transparency. You know, a lot of the things the Department of Justice does, it does in secret, and there's a need for that. There's no question about it. There are things that the Department of Justice does which absolutely should be secret. I spent many years being very frustrated by the fact that some of our biggest secrets were leaked to the press, you know, and what I consider outrageous conduct by people that was never really fully addressed. But you need to keep secrets to do some of this work. But a lot of the stuff you don't need to keep secret. And I think it actually is good for the citizenry. It's good for the department, particularly in a time when people are questioning some of its legitimacy or whether or not it's become overly politicized, for people to see how it works. It shouldn't be that the doors in Pennsylvania Avenue are some closed, gigantic monolith building that nobody really understands. And nobody, I think, actually, I could make a very strong argument. If people actually saw what people do at the Department of Justice every day, most of what people do, they would be very happy with the way that it runs and the way that it works. People, devoted people, busting their rear ends to work hard to try to protect people. That's what the vast majority of people in the department are doing. As I said, these very few cases, whatever percentage it is, 1% of the cases that the department does, 2% of the cases, has been the channel by which a lot of criticism and a lot of problems have arisen. And actually being able to show what happened, whether, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly, I think would be very helpful to the department at this point. So I hope, to the extent that this is going to be an actual useful project and that people are actually going to be able to do this, that those kind of results would be made public so that people can see how their government is acting.
The next question that's been posed is a question that asks whether Congress has essentially provided too much discretion in the statutes that the executive branch has to enforce and thus allow the runaway expansion. You know, I was just listening today to a dialogue between Don McGahn and the former White House counsel and Larry Lukowski, who's the deputy White House counsel currently in the new administration. And they were talking a little bit about the fact that, you know, when the department goes to defend a statute in court, federal programs branch is out there saying, no, it's just fine, Your Honor. The regulation is fine. The statute's fine. We interpret it narrowly. And the court then, you know, gives them the green light and we move forward. And yet I certainly see on the other side, and this was commented on today, so it's not my idea, but I've certainly seen it, that when it comes to then taking these statutes, we see a lot of stretching of the statutory authority. We see stretching of the statutory authority that leads to then settlements and agreements, or sometimes it's consent orders, which then becomes almost a new benchmark for what the law is, even though it's not actually been a legal decision by a court of law, you know, through after true briefing on the issue. I guess the question I have on this question is then, is, has Congress given too much discretion to statutes? Is this guidance memo that's been released, is that designed to get at some of this? How should we think about, you know, this panoply of at least crimes that are listed in the federal code, which, you know, number in the thousands, so many that even we as federal prosecutors didn't know them all?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fraught problem that is largely a result of Congress's ineptitude at this point. I mean, I hear you. You have a criminal defendant, for instance, that thinks a statute's being pursued in a way that is well beyond the intention of Congress and well beyond the actual words. And you tell them, well, we can go, let's go fight this. And it's easy for me to say as his lawyer, per se. It's very hard for somebody or some company to decide we're going to roll the dice on this. And you're right. You give up on that. And all of a sudden, that's the new standard. It's a moving target. The place where that's supposed to be rectified, I think, is in the United States Congress. People are supposed to be able to go back, give them feedback about what the laws that they've passed are actually, how they're being enforced. And those laws should be, those statutes or regulations should be reined in. And I think, again, what's happened is the executive branch has gotten so powerful that, and the Congress has become so inept that the executive branch is just running with all of this. And that's why you end up in the kind of situation that you're describing. You could, in a given administration, try to rein in, obviously, the how broadly you interpret certain statutes. And that's done, as you know, better than most. That's done by DOJ leadership. And you can say, look, this statute has been utilized in the following ways in the last 4 years, or maybe the last 24 years. And we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to, as a matter of policy, we're going to rein it in, and we're only going to apply it towards this scenario, or we're not going to apply it towards that scenario. So you can do that. And again, I think this administration, generally speaking, is looking to curb and cabin the government in general's ability to do certain things, but they're also likely to try to push the limits on certain things as well, on the policies that they believe. And so you may end up in a bit of a contradictory position, depending on how they deem enforcement, for instance, in the immigration space, or in the personnel actions, for instance, where they're leaning forward. They may find themselves in a position where they actually do want to push the regulations in the statute beyond what they normally are, how they've normally been applied. So I think a lot of these are political issues as much as anything else, but I do think, generally speaking, the issue is Congress is just, they just don't really have the capability of doing this with any kind of speed or efficiency.
Let's talk about for a second about a question being asked here about the use of the fraud. The False Claims Act of this administration. What's your sense directionally about that enforcement mechanism in this administration?
Yeah, I mean, look, the False Claims Act, particularly as a result of the QI-TAMs and the ability for relators to make lots of money, is just blossomed. If you look at the numbers of recoveries, it's pretty amazing. And it's a great business for law firms. It's the bane of a lot of companies' existence. I did a lot of work on this on both sides, and I think this is one where I'm not sure they'll lean in so much on this. Unlike some of these other controversial issues, I just don't know that they'll mess with it very much. The fact of the matter is it's a bit of a fire and forget problem for the government. There's such a large relators bar at this point that the government can select the best cases and really push on the issue. We may start to see a change in directionally on what sectors of the economy and what businesses the government is interested in taking on and joining these cases, intervening. I think that will change a lot. I mean, as an example, you have whole departments now that that they're discussing vanquishing and destroying. Those departments are pushing cases, right? A lot of AUSAs in the field, civil AUSAs, are doing False Claims Act cases connected to the Department of Education, for instance. If there's no Department of Education, or it's radically cut down in some way, shape, or form, then I think those false claims cases are likely going to go away. There's a materiality issue there. There's all kinds of interesting legal issues. But as a practical matter, I could see some big changes in the focus of the False Claims Act, but I don't think you'll see, I don't know, I really truly don't know this, I don't see them pulling back on the statute or pulling back on enforcement very much.
We've got just about 3 more minutes before we get to the top of the hour here, Greg. Another question that's been asked is, they've talked about past administrations have focused a great deal on favoring community-based interventions, sort of non-enforcement solutions as part of the arsenal in the Department of Justice. And obviously there've been, that's on the grant side of the house. There's a community organization in the Department of Justice. It's a small piece, but how do you see this new administration navigating what I'd call sort of the soft side on crime versus the tough on crime and funding toward those kinds of efforts?
That's a great question. I think this is something most people don't really focus on, but the amount of money that the Department of Justice moves around on these, on what you described as these soft sort of offices and initiatives is huge. It's absolutely enormous. And again, if you're going to try to refocus your efforts on some of these basic core level, let's keep everybody safe issues, I think I would be very surprised if there's not a pullback from that. I would think that there would be some, and I'd hope that there would be some sort of analysis done to see what works and what doesn't. But I wouldn't be surprised to see the rip the Band-Aid approach here either, that, you know, we have billions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars or millions of dollars being pushed towards one project or another. And this money is better focused on, for instance, making sure that felons who are possessing guns aren't walking around in our streets. So I think you are going to see a movement away from some of those softer community-based programs. But I also think that there'll be some analysis of what works and what doesn't, and hopefully, again, trying to be more efficient. A lot of money gets, I will not be surprised to see an article from Elon Musk's team about waste, fraud, and abuse in some of these things. I won't be remotely surprised, because I don't know that anyone's really looking to see whether for every dollar spent, you have some sort of demonstrable effect in the street on safety.
All right. Well, one more. We're up against the top of the hour, and I want to respect everyone's time. So let me stop there. Greg, I thank you very much for your insights here about the new administration. We're obviously going to watch very carefully and listen to it and read about it. And I appreciate certainly the audience that we had here. I think at our peak, we had just under 150 people, we've maintained well over 100 throughout. Greg, you didn't have too much attrition, and that's a compliment to your speaking about very interesting things. So thank you very much today.
Your moderation.
So thanks, everybody.
I'll echo those thanks. Thanks so much to our panel for joining us and for the excellent discussion. And thanks to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.